Composition. Three bodies in a dark room, one pouring some unguent from a vase, one sitting, one speaking. Well, nobody had ever accused Charlie of having taste. She went back toward the piano. She pulled a second gift out of her handbag, this one in light blue paper. It was thin, the size of an envelope wrapped. There was no card on this one, but she was sure it was the best gift of the bunch. Almost artistic, strobe lit naked Charlie among all that stranger flesh. At noon the next day after Danica's birthday party, Mathilde was waiting. She sat reading the paper in the breakfast room, luxuriating in her pajamas. She picked up the phone on the first ring, already grinning.
"She left me," Charlie spat. "You hell dog monster bitch face cunt."
Mathilde took off her reading glasses and propped them on her head. She fed God a rind of her pancake. "Would you look at that? My dick's on the table," she said. "Seems my game's longer than yours. Just wait until you see what's coming for you next."
"I'll kill you,"
he said. "Can't. I died 8 months ago," she said. She gently hung up. She sat in the kitchen, savoring. The dog on her bed, the moon in the window. In the beautiful blue bowl, the tomatoes from her summer garden had gone wrinkled and were emitting a powerful earthy sweetness just before rot. For 2 months she had left the letter from land there for what she imagined was in it. What? Gratitude? Sexy words? An invitation for her to visit him in the city? She'd liked him immensely. Something in him was balm to her. She would have gone, spent the night in his surely overpriced, exposed brick loft in a trendy riverfront area, and would have driven home at dawn feeling ridiculous. Also, she would have felt smooth and fine, loudly singing to 30-year-old pop, sexy, young again. She had just come back from her penultimate meeting with the FBI detective. He had salivated for what she told him she had. The filthy photographs of Charlie had done their magic. In 3 months, Danica would be a divorcee rich beyond measure. The box of files that, tomorrow, she would give to the sweaty, small agent with the sideburns was her footrest in the kitchen tonight. She kept looking down through the dark where the box was as lunar pale as a toadstool. On her laptop, there was a French movie. In her hand, a globe of Malbec. There was something satiated in her, something calmed. She was imagining Charlie's headlong fall. She pictured his fat face on the television as he was squeezed into the cop car. How childlike he would look, how at a loss. The doorbell rang. She opened the door to Rachel and Sally. On the porch, doubled, her husband briefly shining out. Mathilde let herself lean for a few breaths into the buttress of their arms, felt the weight of her own body relieved for the first time in so long. She opened cold champagne for them. Why the hell not? Celebrating? Rachel said. You tell me, Mathilde said. She'd noted Sally's collar askew, the ring twisted wrong around Rachel's finger. Nerves. Something was up. But they didn't tell her, not yet. They sat drinking. With her long and bony face, Rachel in the twilight looked molded of resin. Sally polished in a silk jacket, chic haircut. Mathilde thought of Sally on her world tour, imagined lushness, fruit in the shape of swans, lovers in damp sheets. The word spinster hid behind it a blazing freedom, and how hadn't Mathilde seen this before? Rachel put the glass down and leaned forward. The emerald tapped three slowing swings against her clavicle, dully gleamed when it came to rest in the air. Mathilde closed her eyes, said, "Say it." From her pocketbook, Sally pulled a thick craft file and put it on Mathilde's knees, and Mathilde lifted a corner with her index finger and opened it. From most recent to least, a gallery of vice. Most were not even hers. from freshest to oldest, all before Lotto died. Grainy photo of Mathilde in a bikini on a beach in Thailand, the failed separation. Mathilde kissing Arnie's cheek on a street corner. Ludicrous. Even if she were canted toward infidelity, he was too slimy. Mathilde, drawn, a skeleton, young, walking into the abortion clinic. Her uncle, strange shiny pages smuggled from some sort of secret file delineating his purported offenses as of 1991. She would read it like a novel much later. Finally, her Paris grandmother and her rap sheet in French, smiling wickedly at the camera. Prostituée, like fly specks across the page. Great gaps here, a lacework of her life's tissue. Thank God that the worst of it remained holes. Ariel, the sterilization, the baseless hope for children she'd let live in Lotto. What Aurélie had done all those years ago. All the deficits of goodness that added up to a shadow Mathilde. Mathilde reminded herself to breathe, looked up. You researched me?
No, Antoinette did, Sally said, clicking her teeth against her glass. From the first.
All this time, Mathilde said. She was committed. A pang. All this time, and Mathilde had been vibrantly alive in Antoinette's head.
Mava was a patient woman, Rachel said.
Mathilde closed the file and tapped the papers neatly back. She poured the rest of the champagne equally into the glasses. When she looked up, Sally and Rachel were both making grotesque, puffed-up faces that startled her. Together, they began laughing.
Mathilde thinks we're about to hurt her, Sally said.
Sweet Em, Rachel said. We wouldn't.
Sally sighed, wiped her face.
Don't fret. We kept you from harm. Twice Antoinette tried to send packets to Lotto, once with your uncle and then the abortion, and again when you left him. She overlooked that I was the one to walk mail down to the box at the end of the drive and back.
Rachel laughed.
The will she sent me to have notarized was lost, donating Lotto's share of the trust to a chimp rescue. Poor needy monkeys are going to go without their bananas, she said.
She shrugged.
It was Mava's fault. She never expected gross perfidy from the meek and mild.
Mathilde saw her own face reflected in the window. But no, it was a barn owl on a low branch in the cherry trees. She could barely master herself. She had never expected this. These women, such kindness. Their eyes shining in the dim room. They saw her. She didn't know why, but they saw her, and they loved her even still.
There's one more thing, Rachel said, so quickly Mathilde had to concentrate to understand. You don't know this. We didn't until my mother died. I mean, it was a total shock. We had to process it before we did anything. And then we were going to tell Lotto after we put things in order. But he...
She left the sentence unfinished. Mathilde watched as her face, as if in slow motion, collapsed. She handed over a photo album, in inexpensive cordovan. Mathilde opened it. Inside? A confusion. A face startlingly familiar. Handsome, dark-haired, smiling. With each successive page, the face grew younger, until it was a red, wrinkled baby asleep in hospital blankets. An adoption certificate. A birth certificate. Satterwhite, Roland, born July 9, 1984. Mother, Watson Gwendolyn, aged 17. Father, Satterwhite Lancelot, aged 15. Mathilde dropped the book. A puzzle she'd thought she'd solved revealed itself to go endlessly on. 22. Mathilde had always been a fist, in truth.
Only with Lotto had she been an open hand. Same night, rotting tomatoes. Sally's perfume lingered, though she and Rachel were dreaming drunkly in the guest rooms above. In the window, a pairing of moon. Bottle of wine, kitchen table, dog snoring. Before Mathilde, an expanse of white paper, easy as a child's cheeks. Write it, Mathilde. Understand. Florida, she wrote. Summer, 1980s. Outside, sun blaze unbearable over the ocean. Inside, carpets in beige, popcorn ceilings, potholders in the olive kitchen silk-screened with the lewd shape of Florida, mermaids on the left, rockets on the right. Naugahyde recliners, a bestiary of modern American life flashing on the television. Floating alone in the hot cave of the house, a boy and a girl. Twins, barely 15. Charles, called Charlie. Gwendolyn, called Gwenny. Odd how easy it all is to summon, like a pain from a dream, a life you'd imagined so long that it had almost become a memory, this middle-class American childhood of the 80s that you'd never had. In her room, the girl rubbed Vaseline on her lips, face blooming white breath in the mirror. She would emerge in pink pajamas when the father came home, her wild curly hair in two braids, and warm up the dinner she'd saved for him, some chicken and a boiled vegetable. She'd yawn and pretend sleep. Keeping their father company in the kitchen, her brother would imagine the metamorphosis inside his sister's bedroom. Legs peeled, pale in the miniskirt, eyes darkened with makeup. A strange creature, so different from the sister he knew, breaching into the night through the window. Her nighttime changes were not despite the fear. They were about it. Small even for a 15-year-old, she could have been held down by any passing boy. A refutation of the girl who had already studied calculus, who had won science fairs by building her own robots. She went shivering down the dark streets toward the convenience store, feeling acutely the untouched place under her skirt. She walked it down the aisles. Bert Bacharach, the cashier watching her with open mouth, skin piebald with vitiligo. Man in a white jumpsuit watching her in the soda section, jangling the change in his pocket.
"Get me one of those," he ordered, but about the greasy spinning hot dog.
Under the angry moth light outside, three or four kids were flipping their skateboards. She didn't know them. They were older, college-aged, though she doubted, greasy hair, Baja hoodies, they were in college. She stood by the payphone, dipping her finger in and out of the coin slot. No change, no change, no change. Slowly, one came closer. Bright blue eyes under a monobrow. Debatable how long the seduction took. The smarter the girl, the swifter these things go. Physical forwardness as intellectual high-wire act, the pleasure not of pleasure, but of performance and revenge against the retainer, the flute, the stack of expectations. Sex as rebellion against the way things should be. Sounds familiar? It is. No story on earth more common. For nearly a year, a besotment of fingers and tongues. Out the window in the dark she went, again and again, and school came, and debate team, and band practice. Slow solidification beneath the ribs, like rubber cement exposed to air. The body knows what the brain refutes. She wasn't dumb. That year she was lucky in fashion, sweatshirts worn huge to the knees. The mother came home late on Christmas Eve. The girl came out on Christmas morning in her flannel nightgown, and the mother turned, singing. She saw her daughter, the bulge at the waist, and dropped the monkey bread she'd been making. The girl was taken to a cool place. Nobody was unkind. Her insides were scrubbed, voices soft. She left, not the same girl as she'd been when she went in. The lives of others come together in fragments. A light shining off a separate story can illuminate what had remained dark. Brains are miraculous. Humans, storytelling creatures. The shards draw themselves together and make something whole. The twins turned 16 in the spring. There were the new locks outside her door, on the windows. Her brother suddenly 3 inches taller than she. He began to follow her around, a goofy-looking shadow.
"Play Monopoly?"
he'd say, as she crossed through the room one of the dull Saturday nights. "Don't worry about me," she said. She was grounded, she had to murmur to the skateboarding boys who hung around the school gates waiting, to the girls she'd known since kindergarten who'd wanted her to join them watching the Dark Crystal and eating Jiffy Pop and crimping their hair. She was always more popular than her twin, but soon a whiff of sex sullied her. She had only her brother. Then Michael. Michael was beautiful. Half Japanese, tall and dreamy, with a fashionable slab of black hair over one eye. In class, Gwenny had spent weeks surreptitiously imagining her tongue licking the pale skin of his inner wrist. He dreamt of boys. Gwenny dreamt of him. Charlie liked him grudgingly. Her brother required absolutes. Loyalty, generosity, things Michael couldn't give. But the marijuana he shared relaxed Charlie enough to make him begin to crack jokes, to smile. So it passed until the end of school. Her mother in San Diego, Milwaukee, Binghamton. She was a traveling nurse who took care of babies almost too tender to survive. They met Lotto. Painfully tall, face blitzed with acne, his sweet boy's heart. Summer stretched out before them. Different drugs, beer, huffing glue, all fair game as long as the twins were home for dinner. Gwenny was the center of this circle. The boys spun around her, satellites. Such a brief time, this ménage à quatre. Only all summer, tipping into October, but it changed everything. On the crenellations of the old Spanish fort, they did whippets with stolen cans. St. Augustine with its herds of tourists shining below. Michael sunbathed, twitching to the music from the tape deck, the glorious smoothness of that body. Lotto and Charlie were in deep conversation as usual, the sea below winking light. She needed them to look at her. She stood on her hands at the edge of the fort, a 40-foot drop into death. She'd done gymnastics until her body turned traitor with boobs. She held the pose. From upside down, their faces against the blue, her brother standing up in fear. She came down and almost passed out from blood to the brain, but sat. The pulse so loud in her ears she didn't hear what he was saying, just waved her hand and said, "Chill the fuck out, Chal. I know what I'm doing." Lotto laughed. Michael's abs flexing to look at Lotto, Gwenny looking at the abs. In early October, they spent a Saturday on the beach. Their father had begun trusting her again, or trusting Charlie to keep her in line, and had flown off to Sacramento to be with their mother for the weekend. 2 free days like an open mouth. They drank beer all day in the sun and passed out, and when she woke, she was burnt all over, and it was sunset, and Lotto had started building something enormous with sand, already 4 feet high and 10 feet long and pointing toward the sea. Woozy, standing, she asked what it was. He said,
"Spiral jetty."
She said, "In sand?" He smiled and said,
"That's its beauty."
A moment in her bursting open, expanding. She looked at him. She hadn't seen it before, but there was something special here. She wanted to tunnel inside him to understand what it was. There was a light under the shyness and youth, a sweetness, a sudden surge of the old hunger in her to take a part of him into her and make him briefly hers. Instead, she bent and helped. They all did, and deep into the morning when it was done, they sat in silence, huddled against the cold wind, and watched the tide swallow it whole. Everything had changed somehow. They went home. The next day, Sunday, Sunrise sandwiches eaten over the sink, bleed of yolk. Bed until 3 in the afternoon. When she came out to eat, Charlie had sunburn blisters on his face, but he smiled.
I scored some acid, he said,
the only way to bear the party at the abandoned house beside the swamp that night. She felt a pang of fear. Great, she said coolly. They took burgers to the beach again. Where the lifeguard's chair had been buried at the end of their spiral jetty, it was dug out, set upright, like a raised middle finger. She abstained from the drug, but the boys partook. The strange thing between Lotto and her sharpened. He stood close to her. Charlie climbed atop the lifeguard chair and stood against the stars, shouting, holding up a handle of rum.
We are gods, he said.
Tonight, she believed it. Her future was one of those stars, cold and brilliant and sure. She would do something world-bending. She knew it. She laughed at her brother, shining in the bonfire and starlight. And then Charlie gave a shriek and jumped, hovering for a long time like a pelican, with his flappy neck, his awkward limbs in midair. He landed with a crack. And then her brother screams, and she held his head, and Lotto sprinted off to get his aunt's car, and when he drove up the beach, Michael picked Charlie up in his arms and threw him into the back seat and jumped into the driver's side and took off without Gwenny or Lotto. Desolate, they watched the taillights go up the ramp to the road. With Charlie's screams removed, the wind was too loud. She asked Lotto to come with her to tell her dad, and he said, of course. Lo, that sweet young heart. At home, she washed off her makeup, took out the piercings, braided her hair in two tails, put on a pink sweatsuit. He'd never seen her plain, but he held in his laugh, kindly. The father's flight came in at 7, and at 7:20 his car pulled under the porte cochere. He walked in the door with discontent pouring off him. It must have been a bad weekend with the twins' mother, their marriage as thin as a thread. Lotto was already inches taller than the older man, but her father filled the room, and Lotto took a step back. Her father's face, so furious.
Gwenny, I told you no boys in the house. Get him out of here.
Daddy, this is Lotto. He's Charlie's friend. Charlie jumped off something and broke his leg. He's in the hospital. Lotto just came a second ago to tell you because we couldn't get in touch with you. I'm sorry, she said.
Her father looked at Lotto.
Charles broke his leg, he said.
Yes, sir,
Lotto said.
Was alcohol involved? Drugs?
The father said.
No, sir,
Lotto lied.
Was Gwenny present?
The father said. She held her breath.
No, sir, he said smoothly.
I only know her from school. She hangs out with the smart kids.
The father looked at them, nodded, and the space he took up in the room was suddenly smaller.
Gwendolyn,
the father said,
you call your mother. I'll go to the hospital. Thank you for telling me, boy. Now out.
She shot a look at Lotto, and the father's car pulled out fast, and when Gwenny came out the front door, she'd put on her miniest skirt, the shirt cropped below the boobs, makeup slashed on her face. Lotto was waiting in the azaleas.
Fuck him, Gwenny said. We're going to the party.
You're trouble,
he said with admiration.
You have no idea, she said.
They rode Charlie's bike. She sat on the handlebars, and Lotto pedaled. Down the tunnel of the black road, frogs singing mournfully, the rot of marsh rising. He stopped the bike and put his sweatshirt over her. It smelled nice, like fabric softener. Someone at home loved him. Lotto stood on the pedals when they got to coasting and rested his head on her shoulder, and she leaned back into him. She smelled the astringent on his ravaged cheeks. The house was lit by bonfires, headlights left burning. Already hundreds here, the music deafening. They stood, backs to the splintery siding, drinking beer that was mostly foam. She felt Lotto looking at her. She pretended not to notice. He came close to her ear as if to whisper, but he was, what, licking her? A separate shock went through her, and she marched toward the fire.
What the fuck?
She said, and punched a shoulder very hard. The head rose, the mouth smeary. Michael. He had pulled his face away from the blonde head of some girl.
Oh, hey, Gwenny, Michael said. Lotto, my man.
What the fuck? Gwenny said again. You're supposed to be with my brother, with Charlie.
Oh, no, Michael said. I booked it when your dad got there. He's one scary-ass dude. This chick gave me a ride, he said.
I'm Lizzie. I'm a candy striper on the weekends, she said.
She nuzzled her face into Michael's chest.
Whoa,
Lotto whispered.
That's a girl.
Gwenny seized Lotto's hand and pulled him into the house. Candles on the windowsills and flashlights that cupped light on the wall and bodies on mattresses someone had dragged in here for the purpose, bare asses and backs and limbs shining. Not of music from separate rooms. She took him up the stairs to the window that led out to the porch roof. They sat in the cool night, hearing the party thump, able to see only a glare of firelight. They shared a cigarette in silence, and she wiped her face and kissed him. Their teeth knocked. He'd spoken of make-out parties wherever he'd come from in the boonies, but she hadn't really expected he'd know what to do with his mouth and tongue. Indeed, he did. She felt the old swoon in the joints. She took his hand and pressed it against her, let him slide his fingers beneath the elastic to feel how wet she'd gotten. She pushed him on his back. She straddled his legs, took his penis out into the air, watched it grow, put him in. And he gasped up, astonished, then grabbed her hips and really went for it. She closed her eyes. Lotto's hands pushed her shirt up and bra cup down so that her boobs pinched out like rockets. There was a new thing, a terrific heat, heat like the center of the sun. She didn't remember such heat from all the other times. He lurched into her, and she felt him leaving, and she opened her eyes to see him rolling, face full of terror, over the side of the porch and falling down. She looked around and saw in the window a curtain of fire. She jumped, her skirt flipping up, what he'd left in her leaking as she fell. Something wrong in getting turned on, summoning this dead girl, this dead boy, so they can fuck. At the jail, she shivered all night. Her mother and father were grim, set when she came home. Lotto was gone for a week, then two, then a month, and Charlie found a letter on his nightstand saying that Lotto's mother had sent him off to an all-boys boarding school. Poor sucker. He told Gwenny, but she'd stopped caring. The entire party, the firemen and the police officer, had all seen the way Gwenny and Lotto had monkeyed themselves. The whole school knew she was a slut. End stop. Pariah. Michael didn't know what to say. He drifted away. Found other friends. Gwenny stopped talking. In spring, when her condition became impossible to ignore again, the twins stole the neighbor's car. His fault for keeping the keys in the ignition. They came up the drive, pondering the sago palms and grasses, the tiny pink box on stilts. Charlie made a sound of disappointment. He'd hoped that Lotto's family was insanely rich, but it didn't appear so. One never can tell. Sea oxeye daisies taunted, nipple-like in the grass. They knocked on the door. A tiny and severe-looking woman opened it, her mouth pressed thin.
Lancelot's not here, she said. You should know that.
We're here to see Antoinette, Charlie said.
He felt his sister's hand on his arm.
I was heading out for groceries. Well, you might as well come in. She said. I'm Sally, Lancelot's aunt.
They had been sitting for 10 minutes, drinking the iced tea and picking at the sable cookies, when a door opened and a woman came out. She was tall, grand, plump, her hair heaped elaborately atop her head. There was something feathery about her, the gauze of her clothes, the way she moved her hands, something disarmingly soft.
How pleasant, she murmured. We weren't expecting guests. Charlie smirked in his chair, reading her, hating what he read. Gwenny found Antoinette's eyes on her and made a twisting motion with her hands to show her stomach. On Antoinette's face, an expression like a paper blazing into fire. Then she smiled brightly. I suppose my son had something to do with that. He does love girls. Oh, dear. Charlie sat forward to say something, but out of her bedroom waddled a baby in a diaper, her hair in twin puffs. He closed his mouth. Antoinette put the baby on her knee and sang, "Say hello, Rachel," and wagged the baby's fat hand at the twins. Rachel chewed on her fist, watching the visitors with her anxious brown eyes. So what is it you want of me? Antoinette said. Ending a pregnancy sends a girl directly to hell, you know. I will not pay for one.
We want justice, Charlie said.
Justice? Antoinette said mildly. We all want justice, and world peace, frolicking unicorns. What do you mean precisely, little boy?
You call me little boy again, you fat hog, and I'll punch you in the fucking mouth, he said.
You only show spiritual poverty when you swear, little boy, she said. My son, bless his pure heart, would never be so vulgar.
Fuck you, cunt face hag, he said.
Darling, Antoinette said very softly, putting her hand on Charlie's, stopping him short with her touch. It does you credit to fight for your sister, but unless you would like me to take a cleaver to your manhood, I suggest you wait in the car. Your sister and I will come to an agreement without you. Charlie paled, opened his mouth, opened his hands, closed them, and then walked out the door and sat in the car with the window open, listening to 60s pop on the radio for an hour. Alone, Antoinette and Gwenny smiled politely at Rachel until the baby waddled back into the bedroom again. Here's what we'll do, Antoinette said, leaning forward. Gwenny would tell her brother and parents that she'd had an abortion. 1 week later, she would run away, although, in fact, she would go to an apartment in St. Augustine. It would all be arranged through Antoinette's lawyers. She would be cared for as long as she stayed inside. Also arranged would be the adoption. After the birth, Gwenny would leave the baby in the hospital and walk back into her own life. She would never breathe a word to anybody, or else the monthly allowances would cease. Echoes everywhere. Painful, the backstage manipulations. How money trumps heart. Good. Press the finger into the wound. Bear down. The girl listened to the ocean, muted through the window. Rachel came in again and pressed the button for the television and sat, sucking her thumb on the carpet. Gwenny watched her, wanting to hurt this woman who reeked of roses, baby powder. At last, Gwenny looked at Antoinette without smiling.
You won't acknowledge your own grandchild, she said.
Lancelot will have a brilliant future, she said. Less brilliant if this happens. A mother's job is to prop open all possible doors for her children. Besides, there will be likelier candidates to bear his children. She paused, smiled sweetly. Likelier children as a result. Inside Gwenny's stomach, a snake was twisting. Fine, she said. How much of this is supposition, projection? All. None. You hadn't been there, but you knew Antoinette, how her lazy sweetness belied ferocity. She would say this speech again, though the dart would miss its target the second time. Oh, yes, you knew Antoinette in your bones. In the car again, Charlie drove and felt queasy, watching his sister cry into her elbow.
You tell her to go to hell, he said.
He would sue that warthog for everything she had, screw the fact that she was Lotto's mother. He'd take her for all she was worth and live in that beach house for the rest of his life
exulting, rich. Gwenny took away her arm and said,
"Money for silence. Don't fight me, I signed the contract."
He tried to say with his own wordlessness what he wouldn't say aloud, but she was having none of it.
"I liked her," she said, though this was terribly untrue.
They showed up at their parents' house because there was nowhere else they wanted to be. Okra and chicken and cornbread from a box, their mother dropping her spatula, coming over with open arms. Gwenny announced both the pregnancy and the termination over butterscotch pudding. It was for Charlie, so he wouldn't meddle. Her father put his forehead on the edge of the kitchen table, wept there. Her mother stood without speaking and flew the next morning to El Paso for work. It was easy for Gwenny to pretend to run away. She packed a small duffel and climbed into the car that came for her when she should have been at school, and was installed in a two-room apartment, all oatmeal carpet and plastic mugs, and was visited by a nurse every week and had groceries show up at the door and as much television as she could process, which was perfectly welcome, since she couldn't have read a book, if there had been one anywhere around, which there probably wasn't, not in this entire sad condo complex with its turquoise fountains, dyed red cypress mulch. The baby took. It took from her bones and took from her youth day by day. Gwenny ate little, watched talk shows all day. "Dear Lotto," she wrote once to the boy banished to cold northern misery, but half the words were already a lie, so she tore up the letter and put it below the coffee filter in the trash can. Only floating in the bathtub gave relief. Her life had paused, but in fast forward the baby was born. Gwenny had an epidural. It was a dream. Her personal nurse came to the hospital and did everything. She put the baby in Gwenny's arms, but when she left the room, Gwenny put the baby back in the bassinet. They wheeled him away and kept bringing him back, even though she told them not to. Her body healed, her breasts hardened. 2 days, 3 days. Green jello in cups and American cheese on bread. One day, she signed a paper and the baby was gone. There was an envelope full of cash in her backpack. She came out of the hospital to blazing July heat. She was beyond empty. She walked all the way home, more than 10 miles. She came in the house to find Charlie in the kitchen, drinking Kool-Aid. He dropped his cup. He turned red in the face and screamed at her that their parents had filed a police report, that their dad spent all night every night casing the streets, that Charlie had nightmares of her being raped. She shrugged and put her backpack down and went into the rec room to turn on the television. After some time, he brought her scrambled eggs and toast and sat beside her, watching the light move on her face. Weeks passed. Her body worked independently of her brain, which was elsewhere, in another hemisphere. There was something dragging at her, an anchor snagged on something invisible below. It took great effort to move. Her parents were gentle. They let her skip school, took her to a therapist. It didn't matter. She lay in bed. "Gwenny," her brother said, "you need to get help." There was no point. Her brother, without looking at her, took her hand. So gently, so tenderly that she wasn't embarrassed. Weeks passed since she'd showered. She was too tired to eat.
"You stink," Charlie said angrily.
"You always stink," she thought, but didn't say. Charlie was worried, gone now only during school hours, her father only during work. The overlap when she was alone was 3 hours, short. On a day when she had more energy than usual, she called Michael's neighbor who sold drugs. He came, looked at her matted hair, her little girl's nightgown, seemed reluctant to hand over the paper bag. She thrust money into his hands, slammed the door in his face. She put the bag between her mattress and box spring. Day after day, all the same, sticky fringe of dust on the blade edge of the overhead fans. Enough. Charlie had showed her his stash of ecstasy and slyly said, "This is how my quest for world dominance begins." said he'd be out all night selling at a rave. Would she be okay?
Go, she said. Make your money.
He went. Their father was in his room, sleeping. Now she put the envelope of Antoinette's cash under her brother's pillow and considered it. Then she changed his smelly sheets and placed the money under the pillow again. She took the bag of drugs from under her own mattress and swallowed one pill and waited for it to seize her, then shook the whole bottle in her mouth and swallowed the pills with milk from the carton. The ache began in her stomach. Already woozy, the air had turned muddy. She collapsed into bed. Vaguely she heard her father leave for work. Sleep stole over her like waves. In the waves, a sweetness, a peace.
Go ahead and weep into your wine, angry woman, half a life away. What do you hope will follow you out of the dark? Morning coming into the window as every day it does, the dog waking on her bed out of dreams of chipmunks. But there is no such thing as resurrection. Still, you did it anyway, didn't you? Brought the poor girl back. Now what are you going to do? Here she is before you, as alive as she'll ever be, and your apology would never have meant a thing.
Charlie came home to a heavy silence and knew something was wrong. The father away at work, Charlie overdue because of the concert. He stood in the door, hearing nothing, then he ran, found what he found. Everything in him flipped over. He waited for the ambulance, and as he waited, the plan emerged, what he would do, the years it would take. He slid his sister's head on his lap and held it there. From a mile away, the sound, the sirens. It was dawn, a thin pale spreading over the distance. Mathilde was shaking, but not from cold. She pitied them, the cowardly ones, because she too despaired. She too was blinded by the dark, but to turn your back is too easy, cheating. The handful, the cold glass, the swallow. The chair kicked back, the burn on the skin of the throat. A minute of pain, then stillness. Despicable, such lack of pride. Better to feel it all. Better the long, slow burn. Mathilde's heart was a bitter one, vengeful and quick. True. Mathilde's heart was a kindly one. True. Mathilde thought of Lan's gorgeous back, muscled and long, the spine a delicate, splitting serration. It had been Lotto's back as well. The lips, the cheekbones, the eyelashes, all the same. The ghost manifest in the living flesh. She could give the boy this gift. If not father or mother, still blood, an uncle. Charlie had known Lotto second best, after all. He could tell Land about Lotto, summon a person out of what, to Land, had just been details, gleanings, interviews, plays, a brief moment with the widow, but Mathilde knew how closed off she was, how she'd shown him only her body, nothing real. Charlie could bring Gwenny to him, a mother. Mathilde could leave Land with something living. She could give Land and his uncle time. She stood. The thing that had given her lightness these past months had fled, and her bones felt made of granite, her skin stretched like an old tarp over them. She hefted the box, feeling all the weight of Charlie's evil in her arms, and set it in the sink. She lit a match and watched its blue edge suck down the stick, and for a moment the lightness returned, the breath to blow out the flame just behind her lips. Fuck it. Charlie deserved the worst for what he'd done to Lotto in his last days, the doubt he'd created. But something stopped her breath. Internal, not us. Just before the flame singed her skin, she dropped the match onto the box. She watched the papers burn, bereft, her curse on Charlie going up in a tongue of smoke. She would send a letter in her own hand later to both men. Land could call his newfound uncle every day of his life. He would. Charlie would host Lan's wedding at his palace by the sea. Charlie would be at Lan's children's graduations, would drive up in the Porsches he'd give them. Lan would be loved.
"That's not nothing," she said aloud.
The dog woke, screaming at the smoke. When Mathilde looked up from the charred mess, the small, dark girl she'd summoned had gone. 23. Decades later, the nursemaid would come into the tea room in Mathilde's house. Blue canvas on the wall, a cool, twilight sense of being young and lovelorn. She would carry a platter of the cakes that were the only thing Mathilde would eat anymore. She would talk, this woman, talk and talk, because there was a smile on Mathilde's lips. But when she touched her, the nursemaid would find the old woman gone. No breath, skin cooling. The last spark in Mathilde's brain was pulling her toward the sea, the raspy beach, a fiery love like a torch in the night, almost imperceptible down the shoreline. Charlie, who heard the news an hour later, took a flight. In the middle of the morning, he outsmarted the locks of Mathilde's flat in London and came in with his halting, panting steps. He was as fat and antique these days as a pot-bellied stove. Through everything, he survived, like the rats, the jellyfish, the cockroaches would. He took the three slender books that Mathilde had written to an echoing lack of acclaim and put them in his bag. Alazone, Iran, Bomolokos. She was sly, but unsubtle in this. In a room in his house, the rest of the print run sat in cardboard boxes, being eaten by cockroaches. Though he was old, he was as sharp as ever. He poured bourbon, then neglected the glass, and took the bottle to the attic with him. He spent a night paging through the valuable first drafts of Lancelot Satterwhite's plays in their careful archival boxes, searching for the first ludicrously yellowed, printed-out draft of The Springs. It would be worth more than this entire house. He wouldn't find it. It was no longer kin of the other plays, having left Mathilde decades earlier one dawn, filched by the hand of a young man who had woken in shame and fury in an alien house, who had let the dog out in the dark to pee and made fruit salad and coffee without turning on the light. He had slid the papers under his shirt, had warmed them with his skin as he drove back to the city. In the end, it didn't matter. Lan had had a claim as strong as any, it is true. A boy who had explained the theft in a letter he'd tucked in a great blue bowl full of ripening tomatoes. A boy who had felt in his bones what only one other person had truly known. 2 years a widow, Mathilde went to see Lan in New Jersey, a production of The Tempest. He'd been Caliban. He acquitted himself well, but alas, there was no spark. The children of geniuses rarely being geniuses, etc. His greatest talent was the gorgeous face he hid behind the latex. After the curtain call, she walked into the dusk. She hadn't disguised herself, thinking there would have been no need. She was a healthy weight, her hair had returned, and it was a natural soft brown. But there he was in front of the theater, smoking a cigarette in his lumpy makeup, the hump on his back, the rags.
"What did you think, Mathilde?"
he called across the eddy of people leaving for dinner, for the babysitter, for a drink. The look he gave her, Christ, it was as if he could see into her dark heart and was sickened to death by what he saw. Well, it's true, Lotto had the same moral rigidity. Had he known all that she had done, all that she was, the anger sparking like lightning under her skin, the times when she would hear him boast at some party, jovially drunk, and hate the words coming out of that beautiful mouth, how she wanted to incinerate the shoes he kicked off everywhere, the lazy way he had with people's swift and delicate feelings, the ego heavier than the granite slab their house was hitched to, how she was sometimes sick of his body that had once been hers, the smell of the body, the flab on the waist, the unsightly hairs of that body that was now bones. Would he have forgiven her? Oh, Christ, of course he would. She stopped still. Stand straight, she told herself. She gave poor Land her largest smile.
Don't lose heart. Onward, she said.
She saw his face again and again as she drove back fast through the night to get home to her house, her dog. How ugly a handsome man can sometimes be. Perhaps Land was a far better actor than she'd ever believed him to be. Better, for sure, than Lotto had been. Well, she knew what that was like. Empty theaters are more silent than other empty places. When theaters sleep, they dream of noise and light and motion. She found only one door unlocked to the street and stepped out of the freezing wind. Even now, Birdbone Danica and Pretty Susanna were exhausting their small talk, waving off the waiter, almost ready to start bad-mouthing Mathilde for standing them up. So be it. All day at work, she'd felt a ratcheting of anxiety, and when Lancelot wouldn't answer her texts, when he didn't come home, she went to find him. Gacy on the marquee. Play about evil, corroding him internally. She followed the faint traces of his voice through the backstage, hands out, shuffling, to feel her way in the dark. She wouldn't turn on a light and warn him she was there. At last she was in the wings, and there he was on stage, of course, in dim light, saying,
"Poor honest lord, brought low by his own heart, undone by goodness, strange, unusual blood, when man's worst sin is, he does too much good. Who then dares to be half so kind again? For bounty that makes gods does still mar men."
It took her to the end of the scene to identify it. Timon of Athens, her least favorite Shakespeare. He started the next scene. Oh, he was doing the whole play. Alone, to nobody. She was safe in the darkness, and there allowed herself to smile at him. Ludicrous, sweet man. And the smile expanded alarmingly in her diaphragm, so that she had to breathe deep, stern breaths to keep from laughing. Because look at him, too tall, stalking the stage, keeping the old dream moribund with these infusions of acting, the old self she thought dead, still secretly alive. But stagey, too loud, not the actor he thought he was. She stood in the black folds of the curtain, and he finished and bowed and bowed. Then he caught his breath and came back down into his body again. He flicked off the lights. He had a light on his cell, and he guided himself out with it, but she was careful to stay away from its dim circle. He passed close by her, and she caught a whiff of him, sweat and coffee and his own human smell, and maybe bourbon to loosen him. She waited until the door echoed closed, and then she came more swiftly through the dark by feel, outside into the icy street, and jumped into a cab and raced him home. When he came in, it was only minutes after her, but she'd smelled the winter in his hair when he leaned his head against her neck. She held his head gently, feeling his secret happiness moving in him. Later, under her nom de plume, she wrote a play called Volumnia. It played in a 50-seat theater. She gave it her all. She shouldn't have been surprised when nobody came. 24. So long ago, and she had been so little then. There was a long darkness between what she remembered and the results. There was something ajar here. A 4-year-old is still an infant. It seemed too harsh to hate a baby for being a baby, for making a baby's mistake. Perhaps it was always there, Perhaps it was made in explanation, but all along she had held within her a second story underneath the first, waging a terrible and silent battle with her certainty. She had to believe of herself that the better story was the true one, even if the worse was insistent. She was 4 years old, and she heard her brother playing upstairs in her grandmother's house when the rest of the family was eating pheasants her father had shot that morning. In the window, the family was gathered under the tree, baguettes and cassoulet on the table, wine. Her mother's rosy face was tipped back, sun full on her skin. Her father was feeding Babiche a morsel. Her grandmother's mouth was more dash than N, signaling happiness. The wind was rising, the leaves shushing. There was a smell of good manure on the air, and a delicious fave breton waiting clammy on the countertop for dessert. She was on the potty, trying to go, but her brother was more interesting with his songs and thumps above. He was supposed to be sleeping. Bad boy, he would not. The girl went up the stairs, gathering dust with her fingertip. She opened the door to the room. Her baby brother saw her and crowed with happiness. "Come on," she said. He tottered out. She followed him to the stairs, golden old oak shining from the slippers that buffed it up and down day after day. Her brother stood at the top of the steps, wobbly, his hands reaching for hers, sure she would help him. He pressed up against her. But instead of taking his hand in hers, she moved her leg where it was touching him. She didn't mean to. Not really. Well, maybe some of her meant it. Perhaps she did. He tottered, and then she watched the baby tumble slowly down the stairs, his head like a coconut, thump-a-bump, all the way down. The still knot of him at the bottom. Thrown laundry. When she looked up, she saw the 10-year-old cousin where she hadn't seen her before, standing in the door of the upstairs bathroom, gaping. This was the bad version. This version was what later events told her had happened. It was as real as the other. They played simultaneously in a loop. Yet Mathilde could never quite believe it. That twitch of a leg, a later insertion, surely. She could not believe, and yet something in her did believe. And this contradiction that she held within her became the source of everything. All that remained were the facts. Before it all happened, she had been so beloved. Afterward, love had been withdrawn. And she had pushed, or she hadn't, the result was all the same. There had been no forgiveness for her. But she'd been so very young. And how was it possible? How could parents do this? How could she not have been forgiven? 25. It was mathematical, marriage. Not, as one might expect, additional. It was exponential. This one man, nervous in a suit a size too small for his long, lean self. This woman, in a green lace dress cut to the upper thigh, with a white rose behind her ear. Christ, so young. The woman before them was a Unitarian minister, and on her buzzed scalp the gray hairs shone in the swab of sun through the lace in the window. Outside, Poughkeepsie was waking. Behind them, a man in a custodian's uniform cried softly beside a man in pajamas with a dachshund. Their witnesses. A shine in everyone's eye. One could taste the love on the air. Or maybe that was sex. Or maybe it was all the same then.
I do, she said.
I do, he said.
They did. They would. Our children will be so fucking beautiful, he thought, looking at her. Home, she thought, looking at him.
You may kiss, said the officiant.
They did. Would. Now they thanked everyone and laughed, and papers were signed, and congratulations offered, and all stood for a moment, unwilling to leave this genteel living room where there was such softness. The newlyweds thanked everyone again, shyly, and went out the door into the cool morning. They laughed, rosy. In they'd come, integers. Out they came, squared. Her life. In the window, the parakeet. Scrap of blue midday.